And basically the problem is that these are defined in different spaces. So to differentiate, for example, vectors, you know, vector is something which lives in the corresponding vector space. So for a given point on the manifold, I have this tangent space, and that's where my vector lives. And of course, in order to differentiate something, I need to compare vectors living in different points. So if I have another point here, phi tilde, then how do I compare the vector here and vector there? And so that's the problem. So how to identify the two spaces? How to identify And so there are ways how to do it if you have additional structure on the manifold. And so the basic idea of the simplest possible structure, which is a vector field, is so idea of Lie derivative. Is that there basically is one-to-one correspondence between vector fields on the manifold and their integral curves. This one-to-one correspondence between vector fields, for example, U, and its integral curves, and its so basically, if you have a picture as we had yesterday, maybe even worse than yesterday. So anyway, so I have some like curves which penetrate my manifold everywhere. So each curve depends on its parameter t, but of course, because I have set of curves, that actually it's called congruence of curves, I have lots of these curves, they sort of like another parameter s, which tells me, you know, specifying s tells me which curve I'm considering, and that specifying t tells me where on the curve I am, okay? So this is congruence of curves. And of course, the correspondence is that my vector field is everywhere tangent to these curves. This is my U, this is my U, this is my U. Okay, so at each point, the vector field is tangent to its integral curve. So now it may happen that I can actually choose, let's say, slice T0, which will determine me one point on each of the curves, and then there is a map from manifold to manifold as I shift along the curve. So I can actually slide this point along the curve, and so depending how big the parameter t is, that much I slide. So for example, I slide over here. So let's say that this is a slice t0 plus t. For each of the curve, and so then there is a map which actually maps each of the points to that point here. Okay. So you can think about this as like sliding along curves. But of course, your vector field U defines, you know, a preferred direction in your manifold. So for example, it can connect this point with that point, and that point and that point, as long as it lies on the same curve. But there's no way I can compare, for example, this point to that point here, because I have no way to actually slide it over there for a given vector field. So a given vector field actually determines you one specific direction, if you want, on the manifold, which is the tangent direction. And so I told you that this map phi t has very nice properties, namely it's called diffeomorphism. which is as much as you can wish, actually, for. So it's a very nice map, and I will now try to explain you what kind of maps you can have on manifolds, and then this one is really, really nice. Okay, questions to this? So let me do it like a side remark or whatever. Side. It's not really side because it really explains why diffeomorphism is good. And that will be maps between manifolds. And so I will make an assumption. So I have two manifolds, M tilde, and I will have an assumption that there is a smooth map which maps one point from M to two points on M tilde. Okay. So let M and M tilde are manifolds. And I will assume that there is a map phi which maps nicely M to M tilde, which is smooth. Smooth and nice. Okay, so then I claim that once you have such map, you can not only map, you know, points on manifolds, but you can actually map all the other objects on the manifold. So functions, vectors, tensors, whatever. So once you have such map, you can map everything. Okay, so the statement is then we find in the following. Induced maps that can serve to map, you know, vectors and tensors and other things. So I think the best is if I just start drawing pictures and proceed from there. So we have a manifold here. That's our M. And then this is the other manifold, M tilde. And so there's this map phi, which maps points from M to M tilde. So in particular, if I have some point P here, so I will denote all quantities on M without tilde and all quantities on M tilde with tilde. So that is very simple. So then, of course, this point P would be mapped to some new point P tilde, which is, of course, given by F per FP, phi P. Okay. So in other words, this map defines P tilde equals to phi of P. That's our map. Okay. So far, so simple. This is precisely what we claim. So we haven't gained anything so far. Now let's gain something. Okay. So you know that on manifold, functions can live, right? So let me just denote this space of functions, F tilde, and the corresponding space of functions here. Okay. And so I claim now that once you have this manifold phi, there is a corresponding induced map which can map actually functions from here to there, not the other way around. So it always goes the opposite way. So it's interesting. Let's call this map phi star. And how it is defined. So of course, I need to say, so given a function f tilde here, I need to say what is the corresponding map over here. OK, let's call it f. And that will be f tilde. Let's not be ahead of ourselves. So F equals to phi star on F tilde. So I define a new function F which will be given by this map, which takes S tilde and produce a new function f. So now how this is defined, right? So I need to specify how my new function f acts on the manifold f, right? So I need to tell you, well, how f acts on p, right? So that's defined. That defines your new function. Okay. But what objects do I have? I have f tilde, and I have this phi here. That's the only object I have. So a reasonable definition is that I say that f acting on p is the same thing as f tilde acting on p tilde. Because I know these objects, so I define new f by acting on this. Okay, so that's my definition. So I define it as f tilde p tilde. Right? Makes sense. So now, of course, the right-hand side is still not a function of p. So I have to write p tilde in terms of p. But I know how to do it. It's phi of p. So this is f tilde phi of p. And my function is this one. So this is nothing else than phi star f tilde acting on p. Okay? So anyway, I define a new function f by using whatever I had on the right hand side. That's intuitive, right? Okay. So this map phi star is called pullback because it's pulling back whatever I have here. So whenever I go direction to the right, it will be push forward. Whenever I go back, it's pullback. Okay. Okay. So that's for functions. That's simple. So now I don't have only functions. I have, for example, vectors, and vectors live on the tangent space. Right. So I have a vector here living on T of M. Then I have T of M tilde. And I claim that my phi, my map phi, induces a map which is now pushed forward and it's denoted phi star with the upper star. Okay, so I need to again specify how this produces. So given v, how do I find a new vector? Let's call it v tilde. Phi star on v. And again, how this is defined, right? So I can again use only whatever I know. So now I know the left hand side, and I want to define the right hand side. So vector is something which eats a function and produces a number. Okay? So it's exactly the same construction as before. So now instead of f eating p, v will eat f. Okay, so I define new v tilde. Now it has to act on f tilde. I define it exactly in the same way. It's v on f. Which is v. Now I want to write it in terms of f tilde, but I know how to do it because there is this map. So this is equal to v on f star phi star on f tilde. Easy piece, isn't it? Finally, I have cotangent space. So Tm star, and then Tm tilde star. So again, now I have to go the opposite direction. And you know, think about it that you can only go one direction. There's no way you can go both directions because you don't have the map, corresponding map. Okay, so again, I start here and want to define a new thing here, omega, which is phi star down, omega tilde, and I define it exactly in the same way. So omega acting on V will be omega tilde V tilde, which is omega tilde phi star on V. Okay. So really, once you have a map phi between two manifolds, M and M tilde, you can build a whole set of these maps. But unfortunately, if you require that phi is only smooth, these maps go only one way. So they map manifold in this way, they can map functions only that way, then can map vectors only this way, and they can map covectors only that way. There's no way you can define it in the other direction. Unless phi is even nicer. What does it mean? It means that it has a smooth inverse. If it has a smooth inverse, if I have phi minus 1, then of course I can define the other map from m tilde to m. And now I can complete both ways of everything. Okay? So for a given type of the object, given type of object, this is only one way. However, if you have more special map, which is exactly called diffeomorphism, diffeomorphism is map M to N, which is 1 on 1, on 2, and it has its inverse, and so both phi and its inverse are smooth. So now when you have the inverse, you can actually use phi minus 1 to define the other set of maps. Define above maps both ways. Okay. So now there is a little bit of misuse of notation. So once you really work with diffeomorphism, you don't distinguish where you write your star. And people usually agree on putting the star only, up. Okay? So then basically you define phi star, which acts on tensors. You are interested in going from M to M tilde, so that's why I choose the upper star. But anyway, so tensors on M, arbitrary tensors now, not only vectors, but also forms to tensors on M tilde. Questions? Does it make sense? Yes? Okay.
Can we always define the covectors?
If it's not onto,
then
you wouldn't know how to define the vectors which are not covered by this function, right? So, yeah.
And I'm a bit confused about the notation. In the second line,
mm-hmm.
you said f of p is equal to the phi star f tilde,
uh-huh.
and it is acting on not p tilde, but f on p. So
right.
I thought that f of tilde can only access the p tilde.
So
how is it possible?
So you start with f tilde,
yeah.
right? And then you map it by this map by tilde to new function f, right? Which lives on this manifold M. And you denote that function f star f tilde, right? For given f tilde, I could get a new function f, which is mapped by this map, okay? So now this function f lives on M, so it eats P, right?
And also the same notation for the fullback for the function.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So it's by like two things are the same.
Of course not. But it's just a misuse of notation if you want. Yeah. Okay. So now, equipped with this knowledge that we can actually map tensors to tensors. We can now we don't have to map M to M tilde, but we can map M to M, right? Using some kind of map. So I'm just moving from Paris to Toronto, and everything else will be moved as well, and so on. Okay. So definition. Now we finally can define what we mean by the derivative. So let phi of t be a one parametric. Group of diffeomorphisms generated by vector field U by U, then the Lie derivative for the first time I wrote it right correctly, and the notation is that L stands for Lie, and then the corresponding vector field along which you are making the derivative is at the bottom. So the derivative U, so this is with respect to my field U, is defined in the following way. So this is my notation. Now I want to do a derivative of a tensor at some point P. And this will be a limit, t goes to zero, whatever I had in that point, so that was my original tensor, which lived there, minus whatever I transported there along the corresponding curve, integral curve of u. So it's phi star t at p divided by t. So basically, the idea is let's say I want to calculate the Lie derivative at this point here. So at that point, so this is my integral curve corresponding to my vector field U. And let's assume that at point P, I have some tensor T, let's say a vector tensor, it doesn't matter. I have some vector tensor there, but so this was already there. But of course, this tensor field is defined everywhere, so it's defined also here and also here, right? So now I take the distance along that curve t, and I take whatever was here, this tensor field, and I move it along this curve to point t. So I get this phi star t of t, okay? And so now I move it to the same point, and now I can subtract them because now they live in the same tangent space. And so the Lie derivative will be the difference. Yes?
The two objects that we've written in the enumerator on this fraction of the t in the denominator, they really live in the same space? Because if we type p t star transport t p.
Yeah, so this is a notation It means that I take a tensor which lives at P, and I transfer and I transport my tensor to point P from something which was, you know, originally somewhere else. So I was originally here. So I want to calculate the lead derivative here, but how do I do it? Is that I consider a tensor which lives here and transport it into the same point. And then, so this is phi star t of t, but now this lives in the same point as the tensor I'm comparing it with.
Yeah. We have a similar doubt, for example, if we define t at p, t is a field, but if you consider only its value at p, then the push forward is going to be defined at 5p, right, in principle.
If you start at point, if you start it here, yeah, right, and then push forward, then you would move it here, right? So this is not the notation. So this means, well, I transport it, basically starting earlier, to the same point. That's the notation.
Isn't it like you're going to transport the whole field, you're going to displace the whole field by t?
Exactly, the whole field is split. Yeah.
And you're going to consider the field at, well, you're transporting in this direction, so technically you're going to have to compare the points at the position which is previous to
if you want.
Okay.
Yeah, you can basically calculate it both ways. I can definitely, you know, sort of, if you want, I this is my point P, so I can transport this guy back. That doesn't matter because t is small.
The opposite of the usual definition of derivative, right? Which is like f of x plus b minus f of x, and then you divide. So usually you take a difference which is from a point. After,
I'll just give you an example. So, the lead derivative is that, you know, you calculate what was there. What was there minus what I transported there. And so let me give you an example, and you will construct many more examples in your tutorial today. So let me just do a function, right? So LU acting on a function. So by definition, this is a limit, t goes to 0. So now let me calculate it at some point, which is characterized by a parameter t0, let's say. F of t0. Minus whatever I transported there at t0 over t. So now how do I transport a function, right? So basically I have to take, so I want my function, some function is here, and then I want to transport a function which was originally here. But how do I do it? Well, a function just gives me a number, and the most natural thing is that you just carry that number along with you to the same point. Right, so that precisely corresponds to your definition of this map between the two manifolds. So if you want, f tilde at t0 is actually the value of the function what it was there before, right? So this is what it is. So now you see that this is nothing else than the standard definition, sort of a derivative. So this is df over dt. If you want, but I'm using my vector field u to actually tell you what this d over dt is. So this is equal to u mu df over dx mu, or u acting on f. Okay, so this is an example, and you will derive many more examples in your tutorial. So let me just give you a result what you should derive. So properties, so this is a definition, and now let me just formulate in like a theorem. What is? So LU actually is, you know, it's very nice because it maps the same type of, you start with a tensor and you end up with the same type of the tensor. Okay, so maps. This is the valence of the tensor. So it's K, we had KNL yesterday, so now we have RNS tensors to RNS tensors. It particularly maps functions to new functions. So it is linear, LU is linear. If you have a contraction, it actually preserves the contraction. Preserves contraction. It's a proper derivative. It means it satisfies the Leibniz rule. So in other words, if I have a tensor product of two tensors, you just act on the first one, and then this, so it's LU on T NS plus T LU on S. So now I sort of showed you that if you have a function, this is equal to uf, which is u mu df dx mu. Now, more fun is if you have a vector, and you will do it in your tutorial. So if you have a vector, then this is equal to, well, we are in the realms of Lie, so this is called Lie bracket. So u and v, which is defined as a commutator, basically, uv and vu. And again, you will study it, what it means today. So this is called Lie bracket. It's a commutator of two vector fields, if you want. And finally, let me give you the ugly formula, which is, however, very, very useful. So if you want to write in components an arbitrary tensor, of course, this is this. So once you establish this and that, everything else is actually given by the other properties, right? So I can use the Leibniz rule and I can use the contraction to actually establish. So contraction first to establish how LU acts on a one form. Because I can contract V and one form, and that will give me whatever it is. And then I can use the Leibniz rule to extend it to higher rank tensors. Okay, so anyway, so the, if I have a tensor which has two indices, alpha and beta, and something else, this is equal to U gamma D over D X gamma. So I'm summing over this index of T alpha and beta, so I first just differentiate my t and contract this u. Then for every index which is upstairs, I put minus sign, and then each index I differentiate, I replace by gamma, which I will sum over beta d over dx gamma u alpha. And then you have minus other indices, which are upstairs here. And then you have plus, and differentiating basically these indices, which are downstairs. So it's plus T alpha gamma and D over DX beta U gamma, and plus it, all the other indices. So if you want, just memorize this formula, and that's enough for the Lie derivative. Yes?
So like, just to make sure that Lie derivatives are always acting on the field, right? So
Lie derivatives is always along the vector field, right? But you can differentiate anything. You can differentiate any tensor.
So, I mean, like, tensor and vector, the Lie derivative is acting on, it's always, like, is it always the field of the manifold, or?
So here I always have my vector field, which is the manifold, that's the additional structure I need. And then I can differentiate any tensor, which of course lives on that manifold, right? But I can differentiate anything. This can be anything. But this is my vector field, which defines my Lie derivative, if you want.
The reason I'm questioning is, like, in case of Lie bracket, like, U is the field quantity that defines the entire manifold. And as you said, V can be, like, filled or not. So
in this case, V is a vector field. Sorry, I should have said that. So V here is a vector field. So that I have a commutator of two vector fields. Yes, it's only four vector fields.
Can you be more precise about what preserved contraction means?
So basically, it means that I can exchange taking the derivative and taking the contraction. Right? So yeah, that's what it means. Oh, you will see it in tutorial. Yes?
Does this satisfy the linearity property? So anything
yes.
in the slots where it takes the vector
yes.
field?
Yes. It's linear in both. So it's linear in whatever the downstairs field is, and it's linear in what it acts on.
Is it C infinity linear in the downstairs slot?
It's
C infinity linear, so if you multiply the vector field that it takes in downstairs slot by a function, does that pull up?
Well, use this prescription. So certainly, yeah, I think so. So the only thing where you differentiate this guy is that you would have a function here, right? So and then you have a function here. But if you have a linear combination, then it's definitely okay. If you have a function, no, it should work. But yeah. Okay. So that's the Lie derivative. The last concept which we'll need for our classical mechanics is actually differential forms. Okay. So E. And you know, this seems formidable and sounds formidable, but actually it's very, very simple. So it's something you already know. It's just a special tensor. So definition, it's a nicer tensor. A differential form so let's call it a p-form omega is a totally antisymmetric tensor of type 0 and p. So it has only indices downstairs. It doesn't have any indices upstairs. So what it means is if I write the components of this thing, it will have p indices, alpha 1 to alpha p, and it's totally antisymmetric. And so antisymmetrization is usually denoted by these strange brackets. Okay. Alpha 1 to alpha p. Okay, so this means it's antisymmetric. And so this antisymmetrization, is equal to 1 over p factorial sum over all permutations pi, and then you have the sign of the corresponding permutation. So if you have 1, 2, 3, and then you have 3, 1, 2, and so on, it's 1 plus, let's say, and if you swap two indices, it's minus, and then omega alpha pi 1 alpha pi p. So basically, I permute all the possible, sum over all possible permutations of these indices and take into account the sign of that permutation. So this is the definition of antisymmetrization, and this means that it's actually totally antisymmetric, right? That's the definition of a p-form. So from the definition, it's automatically obvious that if I exchange two indices of a p-form, then I get minus that. So it's anti-symmetric on the exchange. Of any two indices. Okay. So now P forms have a given rank. So if I fix P, let's say 2, so I have two, the space of two forms. So they form a corresponding vector space, and the dimensionality is very simple. So how many forms I can have which are antisymmetric? So how many two distinct indices you can choose out of n indices? How many p distinct indices you can choose from? So LPX is a vector space. Of p forms at x, of p forms at x, and the dimensionality is how many p distinct indices I can take, let's say from n indices. So lambda p of x equals to, and of course this is equal to this combinatoric number n over p, right? Okay. Sorry? Questions? No? So, you know, P-form is just a special form, just a special tensor, if you want, which is actually much nicer than the normal tensor. You have also completely symmetric tensors, but surprisingly, they are not so nice as forms. But both are useful. So whereas electromagnetism is actually described by forms, gravity is described by totally symmetric tensor, the metric. Okay. So now you can sort of, so you want to specify your tensor product in such a way that actually it preserves the form property. So if you take tensor product of one form with another form, you want to get another form. Right, not an arbitrary tensor, and so it's a special case of a tensor product, which is called wedge product. And it's this strange wedge here. So what it does, it takes a P form, and it takes a Q form, and builds for you P plus Q form, P plus Q. And the way you do it, again, let me do it in components. So P form, Q form, and there's this wedge operator in between them. So now this thing will have alpha 1 to alpha P plus Q indices. Okay. And then this equals to, there's a strange factor standing here, mysterious factor which you will discover in your tutorial. So it's that thing, and of course it's a completely anti-symmetric thing. So it's alpha 1, alpha p, and nu alpha p plus 1, alpha p plus q, and then you anti-symmetrize over everything. So in the end, you need to have a form. So you need to have something which is completely anti-symmetric in all indices. So that's why you anti-symmetrize here by using the definition of anti-symmetrization. Right? So starting with two forms, P form and Q form, I define a new P plus Q form given by that. Yes?
What does it give if P plus Q is greater than N?
What do you think?
Zero.
Exactly. So you see that the dimensionality is n over p. So if I take b p equal to n, how many forms I have? Well, if I take p bigger than n, it's zero, right? So. Oh, it's just at a point. So let's forget about it. If you don't like it. So you can extend it. So you define it at a point, P again, and then you can extend it to the whole space. So by the way, you can immediately check from this definition that if you want to swap the order of these things, then you may pick up a sign. And there's minus 1 to p times q nu batch omega. So you can immediately check that. So now what is maybe more interesting is that we already know what is a... So you already know one form, which is a one form which we defined before, the covector, if you want. So that's a special case of this thing here, just one index. If it has one index, it is totally antisymmetric, right? Because it has nothing to antisymmetrize with. So one form which you know from previous, from yesterday, is actually a special case of a form. Okay, but you know that one forms actually have special basis, the coordinate basis, which is this dx alpha, right? So since dx alpha is a coordinate basis of one forms, you can actually build a general p form by taking the wedge product of this basis. Okay, so that means that general p form in coordinate basis can be written as omega equals to this again. So because of this 1 over p factorial, those factors appear there. So anyway, 1 over p factorial, now it's a linear combination of the basis, so alpha p, that's my components of the p form, and this is my new basis. So I take a wedge product of my basis, I create new basis, so this is a new basis of my p forms, so the basis of p forms, and these are the components of the corresponding form. Yes? I think so. So you really want to preserve this thing here. So if I have this thing here, I want to preserve that.
Actually, you want to instead also write omega, if I didn't care that it was a form, if I wanted to just read it as a number of tensor, I could write, instead of the 1 over p factorial, just the omega components, and dx
and then
alpha,
the tensor
dx alpha p.
And anti-symmetrize. You still have to anti-symmetrize somewhere. Oh, you take the omega, it's already anti-symmetric.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. But you know, so this factor is here because you are, there is many, you are using the Einstein summation convention, right? So I'm summing over this index here, and this index here, and this index here, and this index here, and so on. But I can, yeah, so it's, that's the origin, why you would like to put p factorial there, basically.
But in this case, then, the components, they are already anti-symmetrized, or, because you're putting a redundant anti-symmetrization if you consider both the components and the basis to be anti-symmetric, right?
So I can definitely put this thing here and nothing changes, right? Or I can put it here and nothing changes because this is already anti-symmetric. So I can put anywhere if you want this thing, but yeah. The batch product is already anti-symmetric. Yeah. Okay. So that's a batch product. So now we want to introduce two more derivatives on forms. So one derivative is called inner derivative, and it's a very simple one. And so you can do an inner derivative if you have a vector field. So for any vector B, you define inner derivative as a map. So it will be written as IV, or it will be V hook something, and it's a map from P form to a P minus form. So you basically kill one index of that form, and it's nothing else than the contraction. So E V acting on omega, which is better written as V hook on omega. So this is what it is. And so in components, it's written just a contraction. So you have V hook on omega. Now you have only a P minus one indices. So it's equal to alpha one to alpha P minus one. And it's X alpha omega alpha alpha one alpha P minus one.
X is V.
Ah, sure. Sorry for that. X is V, always. Okay, so it's just a contraction, basically. So why you call this a derivative is because it satisfies basically Leibniz rule. So it's purely algebraic, you are not differentiating anything, but because it satisfies the Leibniz rule, I'll write it down in a minute, then that's why you call it a derivative. Okay, so properties of this, properties, so first, IV is linear. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, that's what I'm writing here now. Linear in V as well. Linear in V as well. So if I have IV plus W of omega, then I just sum over these two things. Okay. And why you call it a derivative is it satisfies the graded Leibniz rule. Graded means that it's up to some signs. So in particular, if you have omega a P form, then IV on a product of a P form and a Q form is IV on omega, batch the other one, and then plus minus one to power P omega IV on nu. Okay, so graded, it means that there's this minus one to power p. And property number four is that if you have two inner derivatives and you exchange their order, then you get zero when acting on a form. In particular, IV square equals to zero. Yes?
In case of graded likeness, should like B and you use same B for the inner derivative?
Yeah, you're using the same V, yes.
Yeah. So I should use the same V?
Yeah. No, so I'm interested, you know, how V acts. So if you want, you write this as this thing, make a new. And then you want to basically how we can redistribute the bracket, right? So it will act on the first one and leave the second one, and then it will act on the second one and leave the first one, but it picks up some minus sign there.
About the 2B,
what is
the other two? Oh no, bad choice. alpha, and alpha. Sorry for that. My new is the same as V, sorry. Okay, so that's a simple derivative. Now a little bit more complicated one, but still very, very simple. And that is called exterior derivative. And so again, it's a map, which is called small d. And now you're actually increasing the order of the form. So it's from lambda p to lambda p plus 1. And this actually is a derivative. So on a function, it just gives you a differential of that function. So t acting on f gives you df, which is df over dx alpha, dx alpha. So for a function, it gives you a one form, and then it's just a differential. And on a p-form, omega, it gives you d omega. So d on omega gives you d of omega. And so if I use the basis here, how it is defined is there's this function here. So I can differentiate that function and I just put a wedge product and the rest what was there. Okay? So this is equal to 1 over p factorial t of omega alpha 1 to alpha p. So now this is a one form because I'm differentiating the components, the function, and then wedge and whatever I had before. So tx alpha 1 dx alpha p. And because it's a differential, again, it will be like a, well, it will be this thing here, right? So if you write it in components, t omega alpha 1 alpha p plus 1 equals to p plus 1 partial derivative with respect to x alpha 1 omega alpha 2 alpha p plus 1 anti-symmetrized.
The p plus 1 comes because you should have a 1 over p plus 1
factorial. Exactly. Yeah. So there is a amazingly nice property that if you take the x ray derivative twice, you get always zero. Okay, so t square acting on anything is equal to zero. And of course, the way to see it is that, well, basically every d gives you a partial derivative, right? So now I have two partial derivatives, dx alpha, dx beta. But you anti-symmetrize over everything. If you anti-symmetrize, so two partial derivatives, they are symmetric in alpha and beta, right? So if you anti-symmetrize, you get zero. Okay, so that's why d square actually is equal to zero. So interestingly, so what does it mean? Well, notation. So p form alpha is called closed. Is closed. If d alpha equals to zero, okay, and is called exact if it can be written as d of something else, d beta. Okay, what's the definition? So now you can immediately see that if I have an exact form. Exact. That means alpha equals to d beta. That means that d of alpha equals to what?
Zero.
Exactly, because it's d square on alpha, which is zero. So every exact form is actually closed. Closed. But the converse is not true. Okay. So any any exact form is closed. So now if you want to do the other way around, if you're asking if it is closed, under what conditions actually it is exact, it imposes some restrictions on the manifold. Okay? But locally you can always do it. Okay? So statement is that any closed form alpha can be, and locally is very important, locally written as alpha equals to d of beta, but not globally. And in fact, if you're interested in, you know, what the obstruction may be, it is the topological obstruction. So basically, there's a statement you can read in the notes, is that dimension of a vector space of closed p-forms modulo the exact p-forms equals a topological number, which is called Betti number. Okay, so it's really something related to topology. And again, you will have an example of this in your tutorial. So basically, for example, a Dirac monopole is something which is almost so the corresponding potential is closed, but it's not exact because you have to remove one axis from your it's called Dirac string, for example. You will discuss that later.
Do we have good reason to call that those conditions as closed and exact?
I have no idea where this comes from. It's just a definition.
And also, does not have connection with the code that we usually have.
I'm not sure. Yeah.
A little bit, because
maybe a little bit.
You think about the d as the boundary operator, right? And then if you say the boundary of something vanishes, you say that's compact or it's closed, you know. And there is this theorem that relates, the boundary and the part, the derivative of
Exactly, we are going to do it now. Exactly. Okay, so there are interesting connections between whatever things we just learned. And so we have now concepts like Li derivative, we have concepts of exterior derivative, we have concepts of inner derivative, and they satisfy nice properties and nice relations in between them. And so especially nice one is called Cartan's lemma. So basically what it says is that if you have a vector field B and a P for omega, then the following is true and it's beautiful. So you have Li derivative combining all the concepts which we learned, right? So combining what the Li derivative with respect to V of my omega is, and it equals to the inner derivative of d of omega plus the exterior derivative of the inner derivative of d of omega. Very, very useful lemma for classical mechanics. So specifically, if I just take omega equal to df, just a differential of a function, then LV of df. So now if you look at the first term, you have d of df, which is d square of f, which is 0, equal to 0 plus d b hook df. But v of df is a Li derivative of f with respect to v. So this is dlv of f. Just look at whatever this is. So actually, lv and d, they commute when acting on a function. Okay, so it's a specific example of this. Okay. Integration. So, forms are also very nice because they are the only objects you can actually integrate on manifolds. So you cannot integrate normal tensors. So for example, in general relativity, we'd like to integrate whatever is the energy momentum tensor, but you can't do it because it's not a form. So, and that's behind all these problems, like you cannot define energy in gravitational field and so on. But if you have forms, you can integrate them. So, and there's a statement that if I have P form, I can actually integrate it over a P-dimensional manifold. So P form omega can be integrated it over p-dimensional submanifold if you want. So if my space is p-dimensional, then the corresponding form is, you know, the dimension is P over P, so there's only one dimensional space. P forms in a P dimensional space is just one of them. So you can write it as a function times the basis dx1 dxp. Okay, so if I'm P dimensions, this is the only possibilities. Only one component is non-trivial. And then you define an integral over this, over some domain, to be just that function and then a Lebesgue integral of dx1 dxp. So this is your definition. Okay. So by the way, you can check that this is independent of coordinates. So if I choose, well, if I change coordinates, I'll have different bases, dx1 prime, dx2 prime, dx3 prime, and so on. So change coordinates. Of course, my f changes as well. So I will have omega equals to f prime, dx1 prime, wedge, dxp prime. But because of the property of this wedge product, you can show that actually f prime equals to whatever I had before, and the determinant of change, dx mu over dx nu prime. Okay, so the so determinant of the Jacobian. But this is precisely what you want from your integral to be coordinate independent, because there's this, is it Fubini theorem or something like that? So then this is equal to f1, f prime dx1 prime dxp prime, right? Because this is precisely the Jacobian which you need there for the change. So the most beautiful statement about forms is the Stokes theorem. And just once I define this you know, integration of P forms, then it's always 1D on each side. So T omega of omega. So it tells you if I integrate omega over some boundary, it equals to the integral of d of omega over that domain. Okay, so this is my domain omega, and it has some boundary d omega. This is my boundary. So of course the boundary is one dimension less than my domain omega, right? And then. So just remember, there's always 1D. So there's D here on the left hand side, and there must be a corresponding D on the right hand side. It's this one here. And it's a statement about how to integrate forms. So basically it tells you, if I integrate omega over this thing, it's the same as integral of D omega over the whole domain. Okay. So that's the end of differential geometry. So it was quite quick, I understand that, but you have the whole weekend to digest that. And please try to do that, because you will use it all the time next week, and then you will use it in relativity, and then you will use it in other things. So try to really understand the basic concept and try to learn these things. So maybe I'll just say, so now we have all the tools, all the mathematical tools to actually understand classical mechanics in this geometric language and in a much more beautiful language. So let me now return back to classical mechanics, right? And so bar f will be geometric formulation of Lagrangian mechanics.
I have a question.
Yes?
Like, because the omega is the field defined in the manifold, like, I not quite get how you can actually evaluate it by using the formula given.
Oh,
the,
So you know, you can only integrate p-forms on p-dimensional spaces. There's nothing else you can do. So then the p-form has to take that form. There's nothing else you can write down, right? And then you define your integral to be just an integral of f, of that one component which is there, right? Okay, we can discuss that later. Okay, so let's return back to the classical mechanics, and there are two concepts. There is a configuration space and there is a phase space in your mechanics. So let C be a configuration space. And you know that this has n degrees of freedom, and these are described by your generalized coordinates q1 to qn. So more generally, you can think about this configuration space as a manifold. So this is my configuration space, C. And then your motion is described as a trajectory on that manifold. Okay, so I start with some coordinates at time equal to t0. This point represents the state of my system, and then this is like a time evolution. Evolution, and you get, at some later stage, you get to qt, which is your final point, if you want. So it's a motion in that configuration space. And so this curve is called, well, I'll denote it delta t. And so basically, at any time, I'll just read off my point there, which is the q of t there. Okay. So what it actually, delta t, at given t, what it gives me is or the configuration space gives you is a photo of the system for given t. Okay, so I don't know anything about the velocities or so, but I know at given time where my system is, right? I know where the pendulum is, for example. Okay, so that's a configuration space, and it's a manifold with n degrees of freedom. Now, there is another thing, which is a phase space. And actually, that has twice as many coordinates. Okay. So dimension of this is actually 2n. And it consists of not only positions, but velocities as well. Q1 to qn, and q1 dot to qn dot. Okay, so now I include my velocities as well. But once I start including velocities as well, I actually am not on the manifold anymore, but I'm on the tangent bundle of that manifold. So the phase space actually is a tangent bundle of your configuration space. So now I have not only position on the manifold, but also the velocities which live in the tangent space of that thing, right? So that means that, okay, let me do an example of this. So think about a pendulum. So just one dimensional problem, and I measure the angle phi as a function of t, okay? So whatever this is, and there is a phi of t angle. Of course, the corresponding velocity is the angular velocity omega, which is phi dot. Okay, so a point in the configuration space is specified by phi. The point in a phase space is specified by phi and omega. Okay, So then I have a trajectory, which is called phase trajectory, in this two-dimensional space, phi and phi dot equals to omega. So you know that if you start this very, very small angle at the beginning, and maybe it's very small velocity, you have sort of like a circular motion in this phase space, right? But then this gets deformed more and more, and at some point, you can actually overswing to another branch. So in other words, if I start with huge omega, so I don't go like that, but I can actually go around and then get more and more. So this is going around, right? So I'm going away with this increasing angle phi. Okay. So now these are integral curves, if you want, in my phase space. And these integral curves have the corresponding field x, which is in one correspondence to these curves. Okay. And this field x is called dynamical field. So now if I can determine this field x from some field equations, Euler Lagrange equations, then I can find these integral curves, gamma t. These integral curves, gamma t, they live in the phase space. You are not usually interested in how the things look like in phase space. What is the velocity and what is the position of the thing? You are usually just interested in what is the position of my pendulum, right? So here, I don't really care what omega is at this point. You just want to know what is phi of t, right? So then all you have to do is project these curves on my axis down, okay? So you want this trajectory delta, not this trajectory gamma. So aim is to find, so this dynamical vector field determines my integral curves, gamma t. Okay, and then aim is to find trajectory. To find trajectory, which is delta t, and delta t is given by a canonical projection from the phase space to my configuration space. See, all the concepts which you learned are actually useful. Okay, so this is the problem, and we will start from here tomorrow.